Ed Salzberg is coming to us to speak to us about the U.S., a destination country's response to the code and its implementation. Ed joined the Health and Human Services, HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, in August 2010, when he became the first director of the new National Center for Health Workforce Analysis, which was established by the Affordable Care Act. The new center collects, analyzes, and disseminates health workforce data and information, which is then used by national and state health officials to help with health workforce policies, health and education sector decision-making related to the health workforce. Prior to joining HRSA, he was the Bureau Director at the New York State Department of Health, then Founding Director of the Center for Workforce Studies at the State University of New York Albany School of Public Health. Then he moved to Washington, D.C. to become the Senior Director at the Association of American Medical Colleges. He's also a member of the U.S. delegation to the International Medical Workforce Collaboration and was chair of that group for 3 years. So as you can see, he's had a lot of experience working in health workforce issues in academia at state and federal level. So please welcome Ed Salzberg.
Good afternoon. First, let me say it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be on this panel. The first three speakers really, I think, set the tone for the presentation. And I know that many of you are probably very interested in knowing what will the U.S. be doing around migration and the code of practice. First, let me say I have no relationships to disclose for this presentation. So I'm going to try and provide a little bit more of an overview on the code of practice, although it was really very covered very extensively and very effectively. I want to present you with some basic data on migration of physicians and nurses into the U.S., and then talk about some of the challenges of implementing the code here, and then some final conclusions. It was already pointed out that the code was passed in May of 2010, and that this, in fact, is a voluntary code. But I think it's, as Alan said, it's a really important code that really does set the direction for future policies. Let me add, too, that I think the timing is really important. While we are going to have to deal with the struggles at the WHO, as you all know, we've passed the healthcare reform in the U.S., the big change, one of the big changes that will come about is in 2014 and 2015, when we will need to, when we will be expanding coverage to more than 30 million Americans. So we expect demand for health services to be rising. And that demand, there will undoubtedly be pressures to recruit and retain additional health workers. So I think it's really important that we begin the process and we move forward on the process of setting up the data collection and the guidelines about international recruitment and migration before we're in the middle of a major shortfall of health professionals in 2014 and 2015. And so it's also really important to keep in mind sort of the multifaceted nature of the code of practice, because it's not just about the ethical recruitment, but it's really about setting a framework for workforce planning. As you know, each country, as was mentioned, was asked to designate or required to designate a national authority, and I'll come back to that to talk about what we're doing here in the U.S. You know, it's very exciting. The 193 countries, I believe, signed the code of practice, really a marvelous example of collaboration across the globe. And we are required to report regularly every 3 years, and that's really going to be important. Now, let me tell you my perspective on the sort of the key aspects of the code of practice. First, the ethical recruitment practices. I'm not an expert in this area in terms of the U.S. I'd like to think that we already have a good structure here with the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Department of State, but clearly it is critical to assure that our recruitment practices are ethical. That foreign educated health workers should be treated fairly in the U.S. and receive appropriate wages. The tracking and data reporting of migration, I think this is really critical. And, you know, conceptually, even if there are shortcomings in the enforcement mechanism, just collecting data on an ongoing basis that informs us how are we doing and where are we is really, I think, critical. And so we'll know more 5 years and 10 years down the road whether we have a more serious problem and what direction we're moving in. So the data collection becomes really critical, which is one of the reasons why I'm involved. As mentioned, I'm the director of the National Center for Health Workforce Analysis. So my role is really around data collection and analysis, and I think that really, again, so central to this particular agreement. And then the fourth bullet I want to spend a moment on as well, the countries need to develop, do more to assess their own needs and meet their own needs. And in many ways, this is the core of the problem both for developed and less developed countries. The fact is there is push and pull, but the reality is if in America, a relatively well-to-do country where practitioners are among the best paid, health professionals are among the best paid people in the community, if we don't produce enough practitioners to meet our own needs, it's really quite natural for our industries to look abroad for additional health professionals. So one of our great challenges is figuring out how do you do health workforce planning here in America. And this has not been something that we've done a very good job at. And we've been sort of willing to not effectively plan. And then when we find ourselves with significant shortages, recruit abroad. It really does, at times, it will at times require us to invest more today in the education and training of health professionals so that we don't find ourselves with serious shortages in the future. So conceptually, if we can do a better job, then we will have less openings and less opportunities. And that's not to say that we think our goal is that we recruit no professionals or that we don't allow immigration of health professionals to the U.S., because foreign-educated health professionals have always played a major role in the delivery system, and I think they really add to the quality and the diversity of our workforce. So the goal here is not that we have no migration of health professionals or that we close our doors to foreign-educated health professionals, but we do a better job at meeting our own needs. I'll come back to that in terms of physicians and nurses in a moment. And then that developed countries should provide more assistance and guidance to the less developed countries. And again, that's not to say that America claims to have the way to either educate, train, or deliver services, but we do have resources. And I've actually been pretty impressed with the partnerships that have developed by American medical colleges and nursing programs, and partnerships with colleges and universities in less developed countries. And I think we need to do more to allow our young health professionals, so many of whom are interested in practicing around the world, we need to provide them with more opportunities. So these are what I see as the key elements of the code. Be clear that we supported the passage of the code at the 2010 World Health Assembly. I was not there, but I do understand it was a long and lengthy and late night negotiation that finally achieved consensus. We have formed an interagency work group led by HRSA, the HHS Office of Global Affairs, and includes a whole variety of agencies that have pieces of this. One of the great challenges of effectively implementing the code of practice is that there are probably 6 to 10 federal agencies that have a piece of the responsibility, and no single federal agency can actually implement this. That requires the federal government to assure interagency collaboration and coordination, which is not always the easiest thing to do, but we, again, are moving forward, and we have formed this interagency work group. HRSA, Health Resources and Services Administration in the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Office of Global Affairs in Department of Health and Human Services have been designated as the national authority for the U.S. We are now working to establish better collaborative relationships with the private sector, the non-governmental stakeholders. For example, there's an Alliance for Ethical International Recruitment Practices and Policies that has some really, I think, innovative ideas. If you stop and think about it, particularly around the ethical recruitment and the recruitment of health professionals, we as a government have a very difficult time regulating the private practice of recruitment practices and what goes on by U.S. companies abroad. But the voluntary efforts, I think, can have a major impact, and hence the benefits of us working collaboratively with the stakeholders. We are also beginning to think about the required report for 2012, which when passed seems far long off, but is actually coming up quite closely. So in terms of how is the U.S. handling this, again, the Office of Global Affairs is the lead office in health at the Department of Health and Human Services regarding global health-related issues. HRSA's responsibility for workforce-related issues, access issues, and so the blending of HRSA and OGA offers us, I think, a good combination to support the implementation. The draft reporting guidelines, and some of you may have seen those, came out in March of this year. We've looked at those. We commented on those. We're looking at how we can, in fact, put together an effective response and effective reporting system in the U.S. over the next year. As was mentioned, it's not something where it's just something that government alone can provide data from one agency. It's multiple agencies, and we also have to report on activities that are going on in the private sector. We've looked at what they've developed as a minimum data set for reporting. We think that we can provide most of that data. I will tell you that they're starting on medical doctors, nurses, and midwives as the first sort of core health professionals that they're looking for reporting on. So we're going to try and provide that basic data. Let me talk a little bit about those categories of physicians and nurses and where we are today in terms of migration. As was mentioned, actually practicing physicians in the U.S., about 25% of practicing physicians were educated in foreign countries. As you may know, in order to become licensed in the U.S., you need to have not only a medical degree, but you need to have gone through accredited residency training. So the foreign migration happens when people educated outside of the U.S. come into the U.S. and enter residency training. And currently, international medical school graduates are about 25% of those who are entering residency training. In terms of total numbers in practice, of the roughly 800,000 licensed physicians in the U.S., 25% would be about 200,000, obviously a very significant number. The largest source of foreign educated health professionals is India, as in terms of a single country. Now, I will tell you that the migration picture gets a little tricky, and the reporting was a little bit of concern because the initial reporting is really about where did people get their education. And as you may know, there's not an insignificant number of Americans who actually go to the Caribbean in particular, but a handful of other countries to get their medical education. So in the initial reporting, it would look like those people were part of the migration. When they're not, they are actually U.S. citizens. So looking at some of our data sources, what you see in terms of the trends in international medical school graduates, the top line is all foreign medical school graduates. The lower line was we've excluded the Caribbean countries. Not that all of those people who went to medical school in the Caribbean are U.S. citizens, but the vast majority are. So this gives you some idea of the numbers. Still an enormous number in terms of the rest of the world, that more than 5,000 non-U.S. citizens are migrating into the U.S. each year. I should mention these are the doctors who are entering residency training, and by my guesstimate, it's probably 95 to 98% of them are staying in the U.S. Some of them come here for training and return to their home country, but again, the majority stay. So this is a significant number. Now, you note that the number is looking like it's beginning to decrease. And what's happening in the U.S., and this goes to the question of will we produce enough of our own practitioners, is that medical school enrollment is rising very rapidly in the U.S., and we expect a 30% increase in enrollment over the next few years. If you don't increase the number of residency training slots, and this is a very big political, financial issue in the U.S., My guess is that foreign medical school graduates are going to be squeezed out relatively quickly and relatively significantly. So that my expectation is that 5,000 number is going to drop steadily over the next few years. I don't know, though, for sure. And if that's not going to be because of a specific policy to reduce IMGs, but really the side effect of the changing medical school enrollment, increasing medical school enrollment quicker than we're increasing residency slots. Talk a moment about nurses. Our estimate is about 165,000 internationally educated nurses in the U.S. at present, as was mentioned at the outset. The percentage of nurses that are foreign educated is far less than physicians, but because nurses are such a large, the single largest health profession, their absolute number of foreign educated nurses is very significant. And so, again, we think it's about 8% of the total nurse workforce being foreign educated. And the single source here is the Philippines as opposed to India, but India still is not an insignificant source of foreign educated nurses. So some of the challenges we're going to face in implementation of the code. As I touched on, the private nature of the U.S. healthcare system and the labor market. Clearly, employers are free to recruit individuals from wherever they choose to recruit individuals. That is not something that we have control over. The reality is, and I should come back to the Alliance. I mean, the Alliance for Ethical Recruitment of International Recruitment has developed a voluntary code for recruiters and for hospitals and others who do recruit, and it would be very exciting if that voluntary code could become well accepted in the U.S. I think that would go a long way of addressing some of the problems in the private sector. Another challenge, I put it as a challenge, but it's mixed feelings. The fact is that the U.S. is an attractive place to work. I mean, I think that's positive, but I recognize the challenge that puts on other countries, less developed countries. One of the big challenges that we have is assuring that we are producing enough practitioners. Being responsible for doing health workforce projections, I can tell you this is really difficult. And as we try and figure out how many nurses will we need in 2020 or 2025 is extremely difficult. If someone could tell me more what's healthcare delivery really going to look like 5 years and 10 years down the road, I might be able to do a better job. But the reality is there are so many uncertainties that predicting accurately how many nurses or physicians or PTs we're going to need is extremely, extremely difficult. But we are committed to really trying to do a better job and to letting our education community know about opportunities. I think it's particularly important in the U.S., given the employment situation, these are wonderful opportunities for Americans and for everyone, and so we want to make sure we have adequate educational capacity. And then incomplete data and information. The reality is we just don't have comprehensive data, as comprehensive a data set as we would like to be able to tell you which nurses came from where, when, and how, and where are they today. We're going to try and patch that together, but it is certainly one of our major challenges. So concluding with the next steps, we will do our best to do the tracking consistent with the code reporting. Our intergovernmental committee work group will continue to address issues identified in the code. We'll build our relationships with the NGOs, and we actually hope to be able to have an open forum to meet with NGOs in the coming months. We'll compile the available data, as I said, to do the reporting guidelines. We are going to try and do a better job in terms of our workforce planning here so that we can hopefully over the next decade meet our needs, most of our needs, internally. And we're going to continue to work internationally with WHO, OECD, and other organizations. So in conclusion, we support the implementation of the Code of Practice. We're going to continue to work in partnerships And many of you, I hope, are familiar with the Medical Education Partnership Initiative and the Nursing Education Partnership Initiative, where we can help give back and help support other countries in their efforts to build their workforce. We're going to have a challenge around regulating, if that's necessary, the personal recruitment systems that exist out there. But I'm hoping, again, that the voluntary compliance can go far. And then we'll have the partnerships between the U.S. government and the NGOs, which I think will be a helpful step towards implementation. I'm encouraged by the progress we have made, but no doubt that this is a long and challenging issue. And as I mentioned, timing is important. I have no doubt that if and when the demand for services rises, if we have not done our job in assuring an adequate workforce, that America's healthcare system, America's healthcare providers are likely to look abroad for recruitment. And so the challenge is now to increase our production and put in place the systems to monitor the recruitment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you. I think amongst all the four speakers, we must have said the word challenges at least 100 times. So there's definitely a challenge ahead for us. And our challenge now, we have at least 5 minutes left, and I know there are probably a lot of questions. I already see hands. So I'm going to ask the presenters to come on up here, and then if you can ask your question, give us your name and your affiliation, and then ask your question briefly, please. The gentleman here and then the woman here next. Please stand up. If you could, if you would please stand up so people could hear a little better. I'm sorry, there's no mics out there.
Mark Kennedy, and I've worked for a number of agencies, including World Health Organization. And in some of the countries that I visited, for example, Philippines, there ain't no doctors or nurses in the area. Very few. They're being sucked out and recruited. The recruiters are everywhere, and they get $10,000 for every head that's in Africa. You go to Africa, Tanzania, and so on. If you're white, people think you're a recruiter, and they say how much, and so forth. So, and there are very few nurses and doctors in the rural areas of many countries. So the recruitment issue, in a practical sense, is, and particularly for specialists, try to find a psychiatrist outside of Manila, anywhere in all of the 80 million folks, and you will do it.
Thank you. Somebody want to take that? Respond to that, Ed?
No, I don't think
so. Should we take a few and then?
You want to take a few? Okay. All right. Ms. Mia?
Yes, I teach at the University of Washington.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll take here, and then there's two in the back. We'll stop with that. Provisions for countries who specifically train for export. Thank you. And there were two other questions in the back, and then we'll end there. Do you want to take that one?
Go ahead. The question, you know, what the code says about countries that specifically produce health practitioners for export. As far as I know, the code doesn't really say anything about that. But it obviously raises the question And we do get that question sometime, that the remittances can be very important to the countries, and therefore this is a good thing. So we haven't taken a position one way or another, but I think that's a very legitimate question, and open to your thoughts about, is this good or bad?
Thank you. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
You know, conceptually, the code of practice, which all 193 countries that signed the agreement are supposed to do the reporting, we're supposed to show, for in, say, the U.S., of those who are migrating in, where they came from. And so if you combine that data with information, and as well as the number that we're producing internally, if you can put all of that data, which I think WHO hopes to be able to do, that you could then see the flow, more effectively see the flows between countries. I don't know if you want to talk about
it. Okay. Yeah, we collect the question.
There was just one other question, I believe, and then we'll have to finish with that. Go ahead. Back.
I'm a former employee of the Department of Labor, the Foreign Labor Certification, so I understand the complexity that you briefly outlined with the recruitment of foreign nurses and other professionals to the United States. My question is this. The data that was presented is, by most standards, pretty old. You had data from 2004, 2005. Would it be safe to say that at best the data reflect moderately underestimated figures, and at worst, seriously underestimated figures?
Okay. Thank you.
You know, we are working to get more current data. I'm not sure it underestimates it. I think they're actually pretty accurate estimates of the both for physicians and nurses. But I'll point out that our data on physicians is much better than it is on nurses, and nurses is, you know, moderate. It's poor, but at least we have a national sample survey. On other health professionals, to be honest, we have even less. And so the challenge is going to be for us to see if we can work with the Department of State and the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the health community to actually get much more up-to-date data. And I certainly can't say that we've worked that out yet. We recognize that as, again, one of our big challenges over the next 2 years.
I just want to respond to two of the questions. The first one was about recruitment in particular also African countries. The basic problem is that most of these countries are also striving for improvements in the quality of healthcare, and they're upgrading the skills of their staff. And that way they become much more competitive in the global market. Some countries have managed to work around this, and I think you mentioned Tanzania. I worked with the government there for 10 years. They still have not physicians in the system. There, and other countries have opted. So there are these classical health workers and the how they're called, medical clinicians. So they're not globally competitive. The other option is, for example, in Tanzania, some schools started now to teach their students in Swahili and not anymore in English. So there are ways how countries can still work around this kind of recruitment issue. But as long as the discrepancies between global supply and demand are so huge, this will be an aggressive market that's not going to go away. So if it goes away, it's because countries commit to be self-sufficient. Second question was on the monitoring of migration. I worked in many developing countries. I mean, the databases are simply not there to do this. So personally, I strongly believe there's a responsibility of the destination of the destination countries to monitor actually what they're importing in terms of health workers. The only way we see now, what we discuss with some of the countries that adopted the policy for export explicitly, is a way that they provide some kind of help to those people to leave, and then they know actually roughly who's leaving. But that is, on a statistical basis, rather weak, and if, then only in those who have an explicit policy on exporting, which is often sometimes politically very difficult. But again, it's a destination country responsibility, no doubt about this.
Sabina's going to respond.
Yeah. I would like to make two comments. First, in relation to the date of the studies, our studies relation to Latin American countries and U.S. and also Spain and Italy. I would like to know that in those countries, most of the countries, the registration of the data, the information on migration doesn't exist, not systematically. So when we have tried to gather the information, we have had to go to the universities, which takes the examinations to allow the migrants to enter the country and to work in the country. We have to go to the professional associations of college of medicine or colleges of nurses, because they sometimes they register nurses. But this is not regularly, and not only in undeveloped countries, but also in Spain, also in Italy. So, of course, in the Caribbean they have a little more, but not that much. So it has been a very, very difficult issue to gather the information in relation to migration, because of the not availability of the registration. Nurses and doctors migrate first for tourism and then they stay, or first for studying and then they come back, and no systematic registration. The other thing is which it's a concern to me and also a question to Dr. Salzberg. Is this a problem of the recruitment agencies, which are not only here, but also mostly in Italy for Latin American countries? When it is said that there is not control or not governance to those agencies of recruitment, so they can recruit wherever they want. But the other side of that is that there are some laws related to visas to giving permission to enter the countries that supports the recruitment, or in other words, recruiters are them because the existence of visas to allow nurses and doctors to come here, and in Italy, for instance, in Italy, there are called Peruvian Nurses Association of Italy, because of the amount of Peruvian nurses in Italy, working in Italy. So you understand, this is like a concern, because in one hand you cannot control recruiters, not here, not in Italy. In other hand, there is a specific government issue in relation to giving visas.
Okay, I know we're cognizant of the time, and I wanted to say, as you can see, there are many questions. This, as Dr. Taylor said, is the first step. There are many challenges ahead, and so hopefully this is something that will be discussed at future APH meetings. We'll invite you back next year. I want to say, if you can all please give a round of applause and say thank you to our speakers, and perhaps they can stay and have a chance to speak with them. Thank you.